Did you ever wish you could get into an investor's head and discover what motivates them to invest? Are you an entrepreneur looking for an inside track on how best to raise monies for your new business idea? I've never met a founder who wasn't dying to know how best to position herself to successfully secure funding. What do investors look for in a founder's personality? Is it their work experience, proof of concept, existing cash flow? What do angel investors, venture capital firms, and the private equity companies look for to find the next SpaceX, the next Uber, or the next Netflix? From best practices to industry trends, Steven Rosenblatt provides incredible insight into the mind of the investor. Steven Rosenblatt is a co-founder of Oceans, a venture capital firm that concentrates in the tech industry. Prior to Oceans, Steven was president of Foursquare, where he won numerous awards, including CNBC's Disruptor 50, Deloitte's Tech Fast 500, and Ad Age's Best Places.
I think every founder feels pain because building a company is freaking hard, right? Like, I think if you're a founder and you don't feel pain, then you're probably not going to succeed long term, because we're in a boom, but what's scary is it's changing so much, right? And so I think as a founder in AI, it's evolving so quickly that as a founder, you have to stay on top of it.
My discussion with Steven took place at NYU's Artificial Intelligence Forum, and it was incredibly insightful. And thus, I am very gracious for his openness. Splat, thank you for joining me on some future day. So I think that at least I have always had this thought, like, I got this great idea. I want to bring it to life. How do all these people get money? Like, tell us a little bit, like, how did you end up in venture capital? How did you end up in this role? And then ultimately, I want to like break down, I want to give these people the tools as to like how they could prepare for someone like you to invest in them and their idea. But let's start. Tell everybody about your journey.
So I started in New York once upon a time, a small little startup on 11th between B and C in the, what we, I guess we call now the Web 1.0 days. So the early internet days. And I just kind of, coming out of college, I said, well, I don't know. I can either compete with all these people who've been in jobs for 20 years, or this internet thing seems like it's going to be something. Why don't I start here? Because there's not a lot of people doing it. I think it's very analogous to kind of where we are in the early days of AI. So I just happened to do a dot-com startup, as we used to call it. And that's what got me in tech and in New York, building companies and being part of the startup ecosystem. Then it became mobile and then social, and here we are in the AI days. But I think going back to, from a venture capital perspective, 99% of companies should never raise venture capital, right? I mean, it's just venture
should
capital.
Never.
They're not venture capital, venture scale ideas. And venture capital is only for, you know, a very small percent of founders looking to start companies, because venture capital needs outlier, unicorn kind of outcomes, just the way the model works and the math works. It's called the power law in venture capital. Really, you need kind of one or two companies to be huge. Otherwise, it's really hard to make the math work. So we look for companies and founders and founding teams that we think can build massive, game-changing, multi-billion dollar companies. But for everyone else, there's lots of other different ways to raise capital. And a lot of companies, I tell founders this all the time, sometimes you should bootstrap your company, sometimes raise very little money. Because when you take venture capital money, it's a different game, and you dilute a lot, you give up a lot of the company, and it's just a different path than most. So like I said, it's not for everyone, but for those who do raise money, and we back about, and made 55 investments since we started 5 years ago. We do about 12 companies a year. We probably see 2,000 plus companies that come across our inbox every year to invest in a very small amount.
So just to back up a little bit, what is venture capital? You started describing all of these other investment mechanisms or outlets, and I realize it's come to my, you know, I started thinking, like, I'm not sure everybody here understands the nuance or the definition of venture capital. So what is venture capital?
It's funny because I, You know, I built companies up until the last 5 years. I was on the other side of the table raising money from venture capitalists, and now I'm on the other side. And so, I mean, venture capital, if you think about who's raised venture capital over the last, I don't know, 50 years, it was companies like Apple, Intel, Uber, Airbnb, right? So it's companies that that ultimately where we give money to entrepreneurs who ideally are trying to build companies that are transformative and generational. That's the goal. And so what is venture capital is no different, you know, it's just money. All money's green. It's just a different kind of a path and strategy.
But so like what's the downside? You're saying that all of these incredibly successful companies were recipients of venture capital investment, but yet you also said 99% of these companies aren't appropriate. They might be appropriate for investment, but not venture capital investment. So why would 99%, such a grand number, like why would they not be appropriate for venture
capital? Because most entrepreneurs and frankly most ideas are not, they might be a really good idea. You might be able to build a great, you know, launch a restaurant or start a company that you're going to sell your product to a very small sliver of customers or people. And listen, like I said, you can build an incredible business that could be worth $1 million, $10 million, $50 million, $100 million and do incredibly well. But that's, you know, venture scale businesses that we need to look at. Ideally, we're looking for companies that can be multi-billion dollar companies. And not, I mean, most businesses just don't get there. And most businesses, when you look at a business plan or a model or look at what they're trying to do, right? I'm trying to, you know, create the next, in some cases, CPG brand, right? Most of those are not really, I would say, venture backable, right? But they're, doesn't mean you can't build a great company.
So is venture capital looking for new companies, new ideas, or like how, like when did Apple take venture capital? Was it at the beginning or?
Yeah, like 70 something or 80 something. Google in, you know, in late 90s.
So VC puts money in at basically when a company's just coming out of the gate at the starting line.
Yeah, so that's what we do. So Oceans, we're an early stage venture fund firm here in New York. We back companies at the, what we call now the pre-seed or seed, which basically means it's typically their first $2 to $4 million that they're raising, or $1 to $3 million that they're raising to get their company off the ground. And it requires capital because ultimately talent is expensive. Engineers are expensive. I mean, AI engineers, for example, right now, some of the best in the Valley that are PhDs are getting paid, you know, $5-10 million a year, right? Now, again, a startup can't afford that. Maybe one of them are the founders of it. So in order to hire the best engineers, the best data scientists, the best talent, you need money. And so so either you're one of the founders starting it or you're trying to attract talent. And so they need typically venture capital to start to build out to pay people and hire great talent. And
so,
that's the cost.
So this sounds really discouraging, right? Everybody, it's like it sounds really tough and scary. Like to make it worse, so just so I understand, when you do invest in that 1%, did you say you're taking about 55% of equity?
No. So that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. Not for everyone. So for us, right, when we invest in that first or second round, so a pre-seed seed company, we're investing early, we typically are writing a check somewhere between $750,000 and $1.5 million. And others are investing too. In fact, we're closing an investment today. I'll give you an example. That founder is raising $3.5 million. Now, he has a real business. He has some revenue. He's already raised some money. But typically, a founder is giving up in each round of funding, especially early, somewhere between 20 and 30% of their company. We are typically owning about 10% of those companies. So, I go back to, as an entrepreneur, you have to think about that, right? So, if you're giving up that much equity, you're playing a different game, and the game is, ideally, I'm trying to build a company because I'm swinging really big to try and build something really big because I am giving up a lot of my ownership over time. Whereas there's a lot of amazing entrepreneurs who start companies, own most of their companies, keep it, you know, they don't need those crazy outcomes to have personal success for what, you know, what and for what they're building. So again, there's a lot of dilution. No, we don't take 55%. Typically, again, each round, especially early, is 20-25%, and then as you become a scale company, it becomes a lot lower.
So let's talk a little bit more about Steve Jobs and Apple, because I think it's really interesting. So if you're that VC that's investing early in Apple and or Steve Jobs, what are you looking for? Like it's you have a big idea and you have management, founders, and that's really it for the most part. I know some companies have gone ahead and they have more than proof of concept and they're actually operating and creating revenue. But I would assume a majority of VC is not a successful company that you're investing in yet. So like it's the founders and an idea. So what catches your attention, particularly today? Let's start with like a founder. Like what makes a great founder in your eyes?
Yeah. So by the way, if we invested in Apple and the next Steve Jobs, you and I would be doing this like on the beach somewhere, not here. So when we look at founders, right, like in the profile of great founders, because that's so much of what we bet on is definitely people first. It's people and team, and then the idea. So we could see a great idea or an idea that seems interesting, but if we don't think this is a team that is going to work, we will never invest in that. However, contrary to that is if we see an amazing team and we don't love the idea, but like the idea, but the team's incredible, we're more likely to invest in that. And that's how we invest. So what makes it, so we invest, I mean, a lot of what we tend to look at are people that are second to plus founders. They've already gone through the entrepreneurial journey. They've either had a lot of success, they built the company and were successful, and now they're on to their next thing. Or maybe they didn't, but we saw that they learned a tremendous amount by doing it. And so that's one of the things we look at. We look at people that, so we backed a founder. She was out of DoorDash. She was actually general counsel at DoorDash, and her co-founder is an engineer out of Google. First time founder, founding team, but she actually was going to build a company. It's called Streamline AI. It's one of our companies. But in kind of the legal workflow space. And she really convinced us early on when she was pitching us, and we saw it like right away, that she had this tremendous amount of insight into what she was building because she had gone through the pain working at DoorDash. So understanding the problem, been through the problem, that type of first-time founder we like, and we love the team, love the idea. When we see founders, we're looking at two Harvard dropouts right now that are building a company, trying to build like a new semiconductor company. That is just like real, oh my God, no fear, brilliance. They see something, can articulate something that just feels like 10 years from now, you can kind of squint and say, that may be possible. 50% of the companies, when we look at our portfolio, which typically, 25 to 40 companies in portfolio, we know half of the companies will go to zero.
So preparation for a founder, like I always think this is interesting. I read stories about, some founders go in and they put together a big deck and they have, they analyze the competitive landscape. They clearly articulate their mission. All of their financial models are running and they are buttoned up with that prototypical presentation. And then lately I've been hearing about these kind of like small abridged, like 6-page decks where founders are just like quickly kind of flipping the pages and they know they're so fantastic and they're securing money as well. So in your opinion, what is the better path forward if you're a founder with an idea and it's just at that stage and everything's blue sky anyway as far as projections and business models? Like, do you want to see a massive presentation or are you looking for something different?
Yeah, I mean, to be candid, there's nothing cookie cutter. We've seen it all and we've backed things on a conversation to like an incredible, gorgeous deck to a Notion doc to, I mean, you name it. I think it's about being authentic to who and what you are. And, I should say too, typically we're investing in, at least one of the co-founders, if there's, is an engineer or someone very technical or deep product. So it's product, like we love the combination of technical and business. So a product and business doesn't always work. Sometimes we'll just, it'll be all kind of sales or marketing, and sometimes it'll be like two engineers, but that magic of technical, non-technical work. But I think it really just comes down to, like, if you're going to pitch an investor and you're asking for money, you better, and especially venture capital, like, you really have to talk about the vision of why this thing, you know, 5 to 10 years from now is going to be so massive. And what, so it's part of its vision, being able to tell a story that's convincing. Part of it is you just have to know your stuff, like, know everything about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and the competitive landscape. I've seen founders come in and, you know, we'll ask them a couple questions or dig in a little bit, and, like, they just don't, it's clear, like, you're kind of like walking out of there being like, I don't know why this person, we call founder market fit, this person is starting this company.
So 99% of the time, in fact, you wonder why that person might be starting that company.
Well, it's not why they're starting. Sometimes it's like, hey, this is a company they should start, but they shouldn't raise venture capital money. They should go raise, you know, friends and family money, or go raise maybe from a family office where, you know, there's so many different pools of capital out there to go after, and everyone's got different profiles of what they need to return. There might be a friend and family who wants to back you because they trust you and they don't need 100x return.
So somebody here actually approached me. They were very excited about the fact that you were going to be on the stage today.
I hope I didn't disappoint them yet.
I'm being serious right now. And the question I thought was interesting, because they said, I'm not interested in starting an AI company. I'm interested in starting an AI venture capital firm. And the first thing that popped into my head is, how do you do that? Like, where's the money coming from? If you're a student at NYU, where's all the money coming from? So my question to you, I guess it's, you know, reacting to this particular person that asked me, is how do you start a VC firm? Like, did you have to go and raise money yourself?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it is a long, painful process, and it is not for the faint of heart, and it is I would say have a tremendous amount of patience. But there's a couple of ways to start it. One is, you know, I think for us, we were all builders of tech companies previously, right? So we, you know, ran Foursquare and started to kind of help really build early a team in the mobile space that we sold to Apple. I've already been through it. You know, I kind of equate it to a sports analogy, which is like, I think some of the best coaches are the ones who've actually played the game before, right? Because players really respond well to them, and they typically are, most of them are successful. We were on the field. My partners opened Facebook New York in 07. They've seen it. We've seen everything from like how a company gets formed to how a company scales to be a, you know, literally a trillion-dollar public company and everything in between. And so we just said, for us, it was more like, I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of founders. I've lived the problem. I've seen venture from the other side. And like any founder, I said, I'm going to start something to solve a problem that I've now heard and seen over and over and over again, where there's very few operator-led venture capital firms in New York City. And so I know founders want that, and I know we can get into the best deals because of our network. We can see the best founders and so on and so forth. So we raised money from people we know in our network initially, some high net worth. Ultimately, if you're doing this, or the big venture capital firms are raising money from pension funds, endowments, fund of funds, banks, et cetera, large institutions, sovereign wealth. I mean, anyone that's raising, you know, in the tens or hundreds of billions are raising probably from sovereigns. So they're raising institutional capital. We're not an institutional firm yet. Maybe one day we will. But I think starting out, like, it's really hard unless you're extremely wealthy, or you know someone who's extremely wealthy who's really backing you, or you've had an incredible exit or outcome yourself in that space, or you've already been at a X name your firm, brand firm, and you have a track record, because otherwise investors won't back you.
So Stephen, how much, like, just to, not going back to when you started, but like in this day and age, today, how much money does a new VC firm need to start? Like, how much money do they need to have as, like, arsenal goes?
Our first fund was $11 million. Our second fund was $31 million. You can start with anything, really. I mean, you just need to...
But if they were going to start today, where would you say?
Probably say you need at least $10 million to
start. And how long do you think it would take for them, just generally speaking again, to raise about $10 million?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends. It could take... Could take years. Uh-huh. I mean, listen, seriously, I know people raising first funds right now, and it's taken them 2 years, right? Yeah. And or longer, and they're still trying to raise $10 million. and others raise it in like 3 days. I mean, so it's all over the place. I think, again, I would not start it unless I'd start it if you truly know something that other people don't know. You have a track record, or maybe you've angel invested that gotten in already where you can tell a story, which is what investors look for. Otherwise, honestly, what I tell people, because we actually hired an NYU student. She was an MBA. She interned with us, and now she's become.
It's funny because the same person was wondering if you have internships. I'm not kidding, I swear.
That's actually pretty funny. Yeah. I think what I tell a lot of students, MBAs, I was at Michigan last year, and I had a lot of MBAs being like, I want to get into venture capital. I'm like, No, you don't. I said, what you want to do is go actually operate first. I said before, because you want to earn credibility. Like, unless you know you have some skill that others, you know, I don't see most typically have. Go get in the trenches. Like, actually see what it takes to build one of these companies. So when you sit with the founder, you have credibility. Especially venture. It's very different than growth equity or private equity. That's more financial management. That's more looking at spreadsheets. That's more looking at analyzing kind of balance sheets. But I think venture capital specifically, you really got to understand how the sausage is made. And if you don't know that, I think, you know, unless, again, you've been really good at building your own track record and portfolios, I think it's really hard to get into venture, especially now when capital is much more difficult to raise than it was 3 years ago.
So I know Oceans concentrates on technology, right? Your prime concentration is technology, emerging technologies. Right now, are you, at least from a macro perspective, do you still think we're in this AI boom moment, or do you think it's slowed down a little bit?
We are,
for AI specifically.
We are in not even the first inning of this boom moment. I think we are at this, you know, I saw it again, like that 1999 to 2001 period was like kind of this, the internet kind of beginnings, right? And then we crashed. And then like 07, 08, 09, that period was kind of the mobile, like this mobile transformation. And it typically, like, we see things happen when you have these big platform shifts, which is what we have now. So I think you have the combination of both artificial intelligence, which, again, we're at the infancy, and it won't look like anything it looks like in 5-10 years as what we're seeing today, although it's happening at a rapid pace. And I do think, you know, I'm very intellectually curious about what Apple's just launched with Vision OS and what spatial, you know, that combination of spatial and AI will unlock. So I think we're at this kind of inflection point of platform shift again, and it's going to lock an amazing amount of opportunity. I also think, listen, I saw this happen early days in the internet, right? So much money, you'd raise money from venture capital, and a lot of that money was really going to buying broadband, right? And so it didn't actually go to the balance sheet and didn't go to operating. You'd have to like literally buy bandwidth. Same thing is happening now with the LLMs. They're buying, I mean, it's why NVIDIA's stock is through the roof, or AMD, because a lot of capital transfer is going to buying compute. That will, fast forward, we're sitting here 10 years from now, it's like cloud, right? It's like, it will be that cheap. And so compute, the cost of compute will come down, the speed will increase, and that will unlock tremendous opportunity.
All right, so like, it's a real issue, and it like fascinates me what you're hitting on, but like, let's back up a little bit and bring everybody along with us. Can you just like talk about this issue of compute and why companies are stockpiling chips, and why, like, what is NVIDIA, and why is that stock going through the roof? Can you just back up and explain that problem in layman terms, please?
I will try and do my best, but essentially, in order to run these models that an OpenAI is building, right, or Anthropic, or Google, right, Microsoft, Apple, I'm sure, you know, all Facebook, all these companies, in order to run to take this massive amount of data and to process it, it takes a huge amount of computing power, right? So the big breakthrough, and again, I'm not going to get too technical in it because I'm not that technical, but the reason we are where we are today is Google's Transformer paper in 2017-18 was basically this idea that we can, the way models are built and the way computers understand things is more sequential than, than it was in the past, right? So that's why an open, you know, when you run GPT, it translates things, and or when you're talking about Midjourney before, these images, it takes an enormous amount of computing power. And NVIDIA happened to have the GPUs, not CPUs. You really need GPUs. And that costs a tremendous amount of money. So it's a huge amount of cloud, huge amount of bandwidth and infrastructure to run it. We need chips to be able to compute enormous amounts of data to make sense of all this.
You think there's a good opportunity for new chip manufacturers, new chip companies to come into play in the United States?
Well, Sam Altman today said he wants to raise $7 trillion to basically build chips. So the answer is yes. Right, like we're looking at it, like I said, a company, a startup, and I think we're going to see definitely a lot of money and innovation. And by the way, it takes hundreds of millions of dollars to try and even launch a new chip, right? Because just the amount to produce it and run manufacturing, again, it's way above my head. I've been learning a little bit more lately, but it's enormous capital expense to try and build a semiconductor company. So yes, I do think we're going to see. We have to, in order for true AI, the evolution, it's going to require new chips, a massive amount of compute, and they're going to get a lot. There's going to be, I think, an explosion in that.
So Stephen, when you mentioned Sam Altman is the founder, and I guess technically not the CEO of OpenAI.
Now the CEO, I guess.
Right? Yeah. Technically, right? But certainly functions that way. It seems like he's creating his own marketplace ecosystem, right? I understand, like from what you just described then, if he starts manufacturing chips, now he's got OpenAI at the core. He's going to create a chip manufacturing entity where he's investing, did you say $7 trillion?
That was the headline today.
Right? And then I know like he's made other investments that are interesting too as it relates to cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. So from your perspective, do you think Sam Altman is creating his own marketplace and his own ecosystem?
Well, I think you're going to have, like we saw, so if you think about the walled gardens, Facebook's a walled garden, Google's a walled garden, Apple's a walled garden, you're going to have walled gardens, right? Now, there's the other school, which says especially, I think what Meta, Facebook's doing, and there's a lot of open source modeling going on, right? And so that's going to be the big, I think, interesting tug of war over the next couple of years. Open source models versus closed kind of walled gardens. And what we've seen previously, walled gardens won, right? Like face, right? All the closed ecosystems wound up becoming the massive dominant players. And I think there's still a good chance that happens. Although again, there's a lot of argument to open source models bring down obviously costs because things are too expensive. I think what's
would you be concerned about the idea of access to information also? Like, isn't that really powerful if the United States government partners, for example, with OpenAI and it's not truly an open source type of, it's more centralized?
Well, I think it will always in this country be, you know, more open than, I mean, this, I don't think the government, I think there's too many people who, and especially in this country, that would be never want to build anything that the government can control, right? I mean, which is why I think blockchain and crypto is, you know, why there's still huge opportunities for that. So that won't happen here. But I think what's going to be fascinating, right? Like OpenAI launched an app store. I think that like the biggest things we're going to be seeing over the next couple of years are going to be more on device, on the edge, personalized experiences around AI. So on device, I think, you know, privacy is obviously something incredibly important, which is why big companies are not going to put up their data, like, you know, I can't speak for MasterCard, but large companies are very sensitive about putting any of their data into these LLMs. But that will change. And then device.
We heard today, I don't know if you were here for our first discussion with Microsoft, but it seems like that data is fair game.
Well, again, I think the jury's out.
Yeah.
You know, what is fair game and what's not. But also, like, what I do on my device is different than what you do is different what you do. And so I think personalized AI, privacy-centric AI, like that will be coming soon to a theater near you.
So you're your founders, like within your portfolio, the founders that are in AI, since you're saying we're still in this boom, I'm assuming that those founders are not feeling like the founder pain?
I think every founder feels pain because building a company is freaking hard, right? Like, I think if you're a founder and you don't feel pain, then you're probably not going to succeed long term, because I think, you know, what's interesting, first of all, we're in a boom, but what's scary is it's changing so much, right? And so I think as a founder in AI, it's evolving so quickly that as a founder, you have to stay on top of it and all the technical nuances that are going on. So, and listen, I think one of the criteria of amazing founders is the idea that you're constantly having to think about what, like, it's pivoting, right? Like the way you pitched your company and then we see 2 years from now, like the best ones are probably like, companies look very different than what they pitched us, and they evolve.
Yeah, so it's interesting because we're talking about AI and investing in AI, but AI touches so many different areas, from healthcare and finance to fashion and beyond. Are there any particular parts of AI that are really attractive to you these days?
I think somewhere between 80 and 90% of the companies that we work with now, there's no question that they are building or have some type of AI component as part of it. So, it's almost like if you pitch us and there isn't an AI part of it, you're kind of like, huh, what are you doing? What are you doing? You know, like, I feel like every company has some. Now, that doesn't mean they're building the foundational models of AI. So I'll give you a few examples. We invested in a company. It's a startup here in New York, actually New York and Israel, but it's called Moonshot. They're in stealth mode. But what they're tackling is on the marketing side. So think about e-commerce. Think about a site. Think about if you're running an e-commerce store, a Shopify store, or a brand, in your marketing. And one of the things you have to figure out constantly is how do you optimize the funnel, the experience. It could be the colors on the site. It could be moving a box from here to here. It could be the checkout experience. You spend a lot of money, probably on an agency, maybe on people, to figure out how you constantly optimize to drive conversion. Well, now, what this company is doing is basically saying, guess what? We're going to remove all the humans out of that. You don't need to do that, right? You can literally let the AI optimize, self-optimize for you to figure out, literally, like, you can hit, you can use Moonshot and it will optimize real.
So it's a business intelligence tool that will then automatically change the user experience?
The user experience will, and run, you know, what we call experiments, constant experiments to figure out, okay, if we change this color, if we change this copy, how do we constantly make little improvements so that we can increase conversion rate, increase optimization without, you know, today humans do it and humans mess it up. So that's one example. Now, for bigger companies where they're like, I care about my brand and I'm not, you know, we still have to have that, you know, Coca-Cola still will never change their, you know, change it from red to blue, even if it drove, you know, 5x conversion. Okay, a brand manager, a marketing manager still can control it. But like, that's an example. We just invested in the company super early. That's using AI to completely transform and revolutionize the medical billing space. Medical billing's huge, right? Half the doctors in this country outsource their billing to these companies. There's thousands of companies all over this country, typically small boutiques. Some are getting bought by private equity. But they have people, literally they hire people to figure out how to put everything into code so you can, you know, code what a doctor's saying. So it's hand done, they're reading it. They're putting it in, submitting it. Insurance companies reject still a lot of it. Now imagine if you can remove the human element of that, because you can take a billing statement from a doctor. It can all be read. It can be automated. You don't need humans to do that. They can spend time on higher leverage.
So that's very efficient, and you're really essentially looking at numbers. But if a brand takes away or loses the emotional connection with the consumer because it's all automated, then what?
Well, that's where I think this is, you know, it's art and science and it will always be art and science, right? I think AI will remove some of the lower leverage work that is being done and allow humans to do more value, you know, higher leverage focus on things that, again, they can go faster now and they can do things that higher leverage. So I'm not like, I mean, I know there was a lot of doom and gloom. Like, I'm more of an optimist on this, which is, you know, sure that it's going to replace some jobs, but I think what it's really going to do is going to transfer jobs and allow people to spend more time doing things where businesses can move faster, more effectively, more efficiently, and actually grow the world's economy because we're removing some of the inefficiencies and cost in the system.
I love that. I love that. All right, Stephen, this is like just the coolest conversation because doesn't everybody agree? Like you're always wondering, what are these people investing in? What can I personally do to get that investment? So you really, really gave us like an insider's point of view, and I really appreciate
it. It's also cool because I get to do this with you, who I have known for 40 years. So it has been awesome.
All right.
I know your time is very important. So thank you so much for joining me today. For ongoing insight surrounding these important topics, you can join the conversation on my social media channels, including Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, at Mark Beckman. And to sign up for my newsletter on Substack, you can find me at markbeckman.substack.com. To make sure you don't miss a show, be sure to subscribe to Some Future Day across all major platforms worldwide, including YouTube, Spotify, and Apple. Special thanks to New York University for producing Some Future Day, and a big shout out to my producer extraordinaire, John Boomhoffer, for being patient and always encouraging me to push through. Thanks a lot, John. Have a great day.